America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. A great nation despite the fact that many people find themselves deeply depressed and deeply affected and deeply discouraged by what they find from major media. Why? Well, because basically the main way that Americans come to terms with what is happening in the world around them is through watching television, through reading newspapers, maybe if you're enlightened, sometimes listening to talk radio. But generally, people have come to lose all confidence in these same major media that are supposed to tell us the story of our time, the first draft of history. As a Phil Graham, who was a one-time editor and owner, actually, of the Washington Post, once described media. There's now a new book by a media insider. Her name is Batya Sargon, Unger Sargon, and she is a deputy opinion editor at Newsweek. Her new book is called Bad News: How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. Congratulations on the book, Batya. First question, you talk about woke media. Woke media is not like the old-fashioned description, which has been around for a long time, of liberal media, is it?
No, that's exactly right. And thank you so much for having me. It's really an honor to be here with you and to be able to speak to you and your listeners. So when I talk about woke media, I'm talking about a phenomenon that's really only 10 years old, something like that. When I use the word woke, I'm referring to something sociologists noticed, what they've coined the Great Awakening, to describe a phenomenon that started to crop up over the past 10 years, whereby white liberals have become more extreme in their views on race than even the minorities who they are advocating on behalf of with these very radical views. And what I argue in the book is that they develop these very extremist, very academic, very specialized left-wing views on race through a feedback with their media. Around 2011, 2012, the same sociologists tracked an absolute skyrocketing in the liberal media of words like white privilege, oppression, marginalization, right? Ideas that are a very, very academic way of talking about race and quite extremist, right? The division of people into oppressor and oppressed by race. And that the use of these words reflects a number of things. It reflects the status revolution of journalists. Journalism went from being a working class trade to being the provenance of elites over the course of the 20th century. It reflects the pressures of digital media, a digital media landscape where people, they want to read about things that make them feel very emotional, and a lot of other pressures that led to the media becoming obsessed with race at the very time that Americans stopped being essentially racist. And I argue that it has much more to do with class than it does with race or politics.
Okay, but when you talk about it having to do with class, I mean, in order to maintain a successful position as part of the economic elite, you got to make a living. Why do you think that the tremendous success of Fox News, whatever one may think of it, why hasn't that led to more of a sense of balance, not the what many people perceive is even less of a sense of balance in terms of the attitudes by people in media?
So I, as an opinion editor, I watch Fox News and CNN all day. I have one screen up with Fox and one screen up with CNN so that I can follow the way that the news is being covered. And I have to tell you, Michael, my analysis from just watching, endless hours of these channels is that the real difference between them is not one of balance. It's not one of facts or disinformation. It's not even politics. The main difference between them is one of class. The Fox News anchor is picturing a viewer that does not have a college degree, and the CNN anchor is picturing a viewer that does have a college degree, and with it all of the attendant liberal values that come with that education. That's the main difference between them. And when you start to think about it, when you see it, it's almost like, you know, you can't unsee it. Everything from the choice of what the hosts wear to the kinds of, you know, topics that they cover, right? I'll give you just one example. You know, on Fox, you will see coverage of crime. You will never really see that on the liberal outlets because highly educated Americans are no longer really exposed to crime, and it doesn't fit into their woke narrative. And so there's almost a taboo on covering crime, which essentially allows it to keep going and festering in liberal cities. You know, the victims of that taboo are the poor, are the working class, are people of color. But you will be able to see that on Fox. You will be able to see that on local news channels. You will be able to hear about it on conservative media because conservative media is geared towards working class people.
Okay, are you saying that you don't believe, I mean, one of the things that people used to say about particularly television as a medium of communication is that if it bleeds, it leads. Generally, there is a, and this is one of the reasons that most Americans were simply unaware of the fact that crime and murder and violence had more than 20 years of steady declines and had reached very, very low levels until recently it's bumped back up. But that was because there was such a saturation of coverage. Do you have any statistical evidence that that holds up this contention that media, establishment media, if you will, of mainstream media, as it's sometimes called, underplays criminality, doesn't give it sufficient coverage?
Yeah, absolutely. So in the book, I talk about, you know, the New York Times, the Washington Post specifically, and the kind of nationalized liberal media, because I think local news stations do sometimes still cover crime. But at the national level, unless it is a white police officer shooting a black person, you are not going to read about crime in, you know, minority neighborhoods, crime in, you know, among, you know, the poor. Like, you're just not going to, like, the skyrocketing murder rate that we're seeing right now across America that happened through 2020, 2021, there were two articles about it in the New York Times. And I'm talking about historic levels of murder. And what that is essentially doing is a bit total betrayal of the victims of those murders whose names don't even get mentioned in, you know, the legacy media in America.
And you're saying that this has to do with the deeper attitudes of the people who are covering the news rather than trying to give people what they want. You don't think that people who are working in institutions like the Washington Post and the New York Times and CNN or ABC, NBC, that they don't have some information on what draws the strongest viewer or reader interest? They look, for instance, at the most covered articles in these various prestige papers. You can find the data on that. And could it be that partially the audience for the Washington Post is less interested in hearing about crime in Washington, D.C. than other issues that might be on a more worldwide basis?
That is absolutely the case. The reason they don't cover it is because their affluent white readership doesn't want to read about it. That's totally true. But so what it tells us that the absence, the taboo on covering crime, tells us exactly who their readers are. It tells us exactly who they are producing the news for. And it's white, affluent, liberal elites who don't want to read about crime. They want to read about oppression. They want to read about white supremacy, you know, a word that appeared 700 times in the New York Times in 2020, right? And not because white supremacy is on the rise. It's most certainly on the decline, right? It's, you know, white supremacists are marginalized, right? They're on the margins of society. So why is it now we're reading about it by an increase of 1,200% every year? It's because that is what white affluent liberals that who are the target of the New York Times, the target of legacy media, what they want to read about.
Batya, can you hang with us for another segment?
Of course, it's my pleasure.
Good. We'll be right back with Batya Unger Sargon, the author of Bad News. The book is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. And it's a pleasure to be speaking to Batya Unger-Sargon, who is the author of the new book and already a bestseller in the categories of journalism, writing, and reference. It's called Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy, and just released at the end of last month. And congratulations on the book, Batya. Let me test out part of what you're arguing here, because it seems to me directly relevant. We'll talk about this at greater length tomorrow. There's a new item that's lighting up the internet, brand new, and I don't know if you're even have come to terms with it yet, Batya. But survey, this is the headline, 39% of 18 to 24-year-old Americans identify as LGBTQ. Now, again, I've followed this for a long time. If this is even vaguely true, 39% of young people between the ages of 18 and 24 say they're LGBTQ, the highest number by any reputable polling operation ever is 4%, and that's based on exit polls from elections, and which, of course, includes a lot of people who, by the way, have opposite-sex marriages, male-female marriages, but who prefer to define themselves as bisexual. Who would this news be exciting to? In other words, if you're right that mainstream media are trying very hard to appeal to a specific audience, it's tough for me to figure out which audience for this survey, which was conducted, by the way, by Arizona Christian University in connection with Foundations of Freedom, who this news was meant to attract.
You mean the people covering the study or the people who did the study?
No, the people who are covering the study and who, in other words, who do you think that why would this be running as a headline anywhere, given the fact that I don't think these numbers are even vaguely credible?
Meaning, why are they covering something that just sounds like totally ridiculous? That's probably not true. But you're seeing it everywhere, and you're seeing it in liberal media or in conservative media?
Yeah, I see it everywhere, and both both sides, all sides, don't you? I mean, in other words, the basically things that indicate that we are in a state of crisis. I mean, it's something I've written about and talked about for years. We don't have a news business anymore. We have a bad news business.
Right.
Stuff that is reassuring about the United States that shows that, you know, we're not so bad. The 65% of people in a new Fox News poll showed that they still thought that America was the best place in the world to live. Now, that's a lot of people. And yet what you hear in media is it's the same idea that if a plane lands safely, it's never in the news. That's kind of normal. But if something goes wrong, if something looks weird or strange or bizarre or new, that gets all the attention in the world. And it's not just from liberal media, is it?
No, definitely not. I mean, like this study, for example, conservative media would be very excited to publish it because it seems to suggest, like you said, a state of crisis, right? In 50 years, if, you know, 60% of Americans are LGBTQ, that's basically the end of, you know, our reproductive capacity, right? So that's sort of crisis and fear mongering on the part of the right. And of course, the left would want to promote this because it helps their agenda, because their agenda is very much geared towards the marginalized, quote unquote, or people who, you know, are from minority groups or minority identity groups or people who are, you know, not part of the mainstream. And so if they can say, oh, look, it's like 36%, we need to therefore amend our laws to protect these citizens, right? So it's kind of the perfect survey to get both sides exercised around their, you know, unique agendas, right?
Yeah, I can understand that argument. But one of the questions, and I have not read this part of your book yet, and I know you cover it. What needs to be fixed if you argue, and you do, and I think most Americans agree with you and recognize it, that there is a very strong leftward tilt in prestige media in this country, and particularly on issues of race, as you say. What do you do to fix it?
Well, like you, I'm religious, so I think that we fix it in our hearts. You know, there's a very wide consumer boycott of the news from people who don't fit into that, you know, 6% themselves to be the progressive left, right? Everybody else is checked out of the news. I don't think that's a bad thing, Michael. I mean, I think that we have replaced spirituality and community in this country with, you know, information and information about politics and information about national politics, and I don't think we need to know that much. So I think the consumer boycott of the news is positive. You know, we need to go back to church, go back to shul, go back to volunteering, go back to your community, find people you disagree with. We need to all be together working on stitching back together the fabric of American society at a spiritual level. I mean, I think that's how we fix it. And it relates to the media because, you know, the way I think about it, Michael, is like every time you're on the internet and you feel that feeling of rage, you know, that like road rage feeling when somebody says something you disagree with and you want to kill them and you have to tweet something mean about it, whatever. Every time we feel that feeling when we're on social media, someone's making $1 million. That we have been, it's not natural or normal to feel that way about people that you disagree with who you've never met, who are just strangers. And so to me, the way we fix it, like by fixing our souls and by reminding ourselves what it feels like to respect somebody who's pro-life or pro-choice, like to remind ourselves that a healthy democracy must be able to have people who are both pro and anti-gun and pro and anti-abortion and pro and anti-affirmative action. Like that's the name of the game. So I don't know that you can fit. I mean, the New York Times is doing extremely well because it wants those, it has those 6 million highly affluent progressive left Americans and is very happy with them. They're giving them a lot of money. So I don't know that we can fix the New York Times. I don't know that we can fix corporations, you know, that are getting rich off of this. But I know that we can fix our own hearts and we can remember what it means to be American.
Well, even something maybe less sweeping. I was speaking last night at the Reagan Library, Batya. And mm-hmm. one of the things I quoted Margaret Thatcher, actually a biography of Margaret Thatcher by Charles Moore, who said that what allowed her to be so successful was her passionate love of country. And it was mm-hmm. an extraordinary love. It was beyond uh-huh. normal. And what he argued was no leader ever accomplishes anything out of the ordinary except with that wild and passionate and deep love of country. And again, especially as we approach Thanksgiving, it seems to me that your outstanding answer, and I like your answer a great deal, that to basically balance some of the media messages, which are all horror and fright, that help people make $1 million each time you believe it, come into Thanksgiving with appreciation for the blessings we do have. One of those blessings, a new book, Bad News, How Woke Media is Undermining Democracy. It is by Batya Ungar-Sargon. Congratulations on it. Come back and we'll talk further. Michael Medved show, what is totally fascinating to me right now, along with the topic we were discussing with Batya Ungar-Sargon, the idea that news media have very different expectations of what their audience wants, and I think it's true to some extent. What I don't fully agree with, and we'll have her back on and talk about it to her later, is the implication that all conservative news is aimed toward people without college degrees who are not part of the university-educated elite. And you think about the Wall Street Journal, and if you look at the material that's in there, a lot of it is very intellectually challenging. They, by the way, do give some attention to people from the center-left. William Galston, who is a regular columnist there, is a former Clinton aide who's does a good job, as I think pretty much most people who write for the journal do. But in any event, there is this right now about the fascination, which is across the board, with the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. And this is not just being promoted by conservative media, where, of course, I think there's a lot more natural sympathy for Kyle Rittenhouse. And I think the sympathy is appropriate, because the idea that he was an aggressor, as Andrew McCarthy points out, is just not credible. And what's fascinating is to listen to the floundering attorney who's handling most of the prosecution, whose name is Thomas Binger. And here he was in the trial earlier today, going after Kyle Rittenhouse on his violation of the curfew that had been imposed in Kenosha. Now, he wasn't the only one. There were hundreds of people who were obviously violating the curfew, and that doesn't mean violating the curfew was a good thing or an acceptable thing. But really, he's on trial for murder, and they're going to try to prove him as a murderer based upon the fact that he violated curfew? Listen to this exchange. It's clip five.
There are a lot of roads closed off. I couldn't tell you exactly their names right now.
Was that because there was construction going on?
No, they were closed off because of the riots.
They were closed off to keep people out of the area, right?
Yes.
And you knew there was a curfew that night, right?
I believe I got an emergency alert text at around 8 p.m.
Just like everybody else, saying, stay off the streets.
Charge.
I'm sorry.
Objection. There's no curfew charge.
It's still relevant to his decision making. Just like everybody else, you got a message saying, get off the streets at 8 o'clock that night, right?
Yes.
And despite that message, you came down, correct?
I was already in Kenosha downtown when I got that message.
Once he got that message, you didn't decide, I'm going to leave and go home like I'm supposed to, correct?
I stayed at the car source.
And you knew that there was this curfew in place that meant you shouldn't be there anymore, correct?
There are, I'd say, hundreds, if not thousands, of other people there that night that also got the same message.
So if they're all breaking the law, you can too?
I don't think the curfew was really being enforced.
So if a law is not being enforced, you can disregard it?
Your Honor.
I'm sorry, Commander.
Okay, really, where is he going with this? I mean, of course he broke the right thing, of course. I wish Kyle Rittenhouse would have said, and I'm sure it's true, is I wish I had followed the law and gone home and not ended up harming people, killing people, and putting myself in this situation. I mean, honest to goodness, it shouldn't be that hard. And the idea that he didn't follow the curfew, he didn't do something that, as he pointed out, literally thousands of other people didn't do, that should be relevant and material to actually getting him convicted on a murder charge. This is unbelievable. The real explosion that occurred, that I think is fairly dramatic, has to do with the instructions that the judge had given that had been ignored by the prosecution. Here is the defense attorney calling for the judge to admonish the prosecutor's line of questioning, and which ultimately led him to want to call for a mistrial. This is 3A.
It's either forgetting court's rulings or attempting to provoke a mistrial in this matter. He knows he can't go into this, and he's asking the questions. I ask the court to strongly admonish him, and the next time it happens, I'll be asking for a mistrial with prejudice. He's an experienced attorney, and he knows better.
Mr. Finger?
First of all, Your Honor, this was the subject of a motion. I'm well aware of that.
and the court left the door open.
This for me, not for you.
My
That's
understanding
the judge.
You should have come and asked for reconsideration. I indicated a bias towards denial is what I did. Held it open with a bias towards denial. Why would you think that that made it okay for you without any advance notice to bring this matter before the jury? You are already, I was astonished when you began your examination by commenting on the defendant's post-arrest silence. That's basic law. It's been basic law in this country for 40 years, 50 years. I have no idea why you would do something like that. And it gives, I'll leave it at that. So I don't know what you're up to.
And that leads the defense to make a strong stand. This is clip 9.
I think the court has to make some findings as it relates to the bad faith on the part of the prosecution. And if the court makes a finding that the actions that I had talked about were done in bad faith, then I think both elements for mistrial with prejudice have been met. And I think under the circumstances, based on what I've put forth on the record, I would certainly ask the court to consider those. And I would ask the court grant the motion with prejudice. Thank you.
Okay. It seems to me, is a fairly strong statement. And it's based upon this whole idea that they are trying to go for a mistrial. With mistrial with prejudice, they can't then bring it up again. They're done. They basically, it means that it's as close to being cleared as Kyle Rittenhouse can be. But the idea of a normal mistrial where they have what is called a hung jury, where they cannot decide, that basically would give them the chance to have another go at it. And obviously, as a good defense attorney, they don't want to put young Mr. Rittenhouse through that additional ordeal. I do think that basically it's media, it's basically activists on all sides. There is so much that is blameworthy about this case and about the tragic death of two of the demonstrators last August of 2020. And I hope we can actually take some constructive lessons, not just for Kyle Rittenhouse, but for everybody who's watching this thing so avidly. We'll be right back.
The Michael Medved Show. MichaelMedved.com.
And on the Michael Medved Show, something happened last night that made me feel, well, actually a lot of things that made me feel great. I was able to go to this speech at Reagan Library with my wife Diane and with my brother Harry and Harry's wife, and I'm proud of my family and very grateful for their company in events like that. But also I was signing books afterward. And there was a family that came up to me, and they had two of their six children with them, an extremely clean-cut, lovely family. And I wasn't at all surprised when the parents told me, and their two boys who they had with them, they didn't have all boys for the six kids, but they're homeschoolers. And the mother who does the bulk of the homeschooling said she wanted to thank me because she had used our history programs as the backbone of their homeschool curriculum. And then the boys chirped up and said how much they liked them and they enjoyed them and it's great and they wish that all history was like that. And of course, that gives me an opportunity to not only tell you about this very flattering and extremely gratifying encounter, but to remind you of your opportunity to have access to every one of our history programs, all of them, and there's 80 of them. It's a whole curriculum, really, in American history, and it's all free if you join us as a MedHead Plus member. And this is a cost of 11 cents a day, and you can download as many of our history programs as you want on any given day, and it's free. Just that cost to be a MedHead member at 11 cents a day, a total of $79 a year. It's a great opportunity. Join us. Go to michaelmedved.com, or even better, go to medvedhistorystore.com and look at everything we have on offer and everything that you would gain aside from the regular show we do every day, all of the history programs that we do. And that's available, again, free to MedHead Plus members at a greatly reduced cost as part of this introductory offer. I don't know how long that reduced cost is going to last, but it's very much on now. Go to michaelmedved.com or medvedhistorystore.com. And speaking of our history, there's a profound point, and it's very, very important to remember. This is made by Brett Stevens in the New York Times. And the headline is fantastic, and it's related to what we were talking about earlier with Batya Unger Sargon. And Brett Stevens writes a piece called Why Wokeness Will Fail. And he says, American history is in many ways a story of grand protests. They generally come in two types. There are protest movements that, even in ferocious dissent, believe that the American system is ultimately geared to fulfill its inner promises of equality, of inalienable rights, the pursuit of happiness, e pluribus unum, a more perfect union. And then there are protest movements that have turned against our system, either because they don't think the system can meet the promises, or because they never agreed with the promises of our system in the first place. The experience of nearly 250 years is that the first type of movement generally succeeds. Emancipation, women's suffrage, civil rights, marriage equality. They have aimed to build the country up and to bring Americans more closely together on foundations already in place. The second type, from the Confederacy to the white supremacy of the Jim Crow era to militant black nationalism in the 1960s, always fail. These movements want to tear things down, divide Americans, reject and replace our national foundations. Isn't that a tremendous point? And you think about how profoundly that applies to the very different rhetoric, the very different events that you see. When Martin Luther King spoke before that historic March on Washington in August of 1963, what did he say? He quoted our founding documents. He said, sweet land of liberty, let freedom ring. He talked about the American founding and paying the debt of the American founding, cashing the uncashed check that people who had been denied too long had not received. And that movement was wildly successful. It literally, in less than 5 years, an entire system of segregation that had applied across a dozen states in the United States, that system was wiped out. It was replaced. It was extirpated. And all of a sudden, the idea of racial prejudice, of counting people, of labeling people according to race, was held to be unacceptable. And now wokeness is basically saying that never happened. because America was founded on racism. It's only had racism. And basically, the only way to get rid of racism is to get rid of America as we understand it. And I again, I'd love to have Brett on to talk about this because he says this. The ideology come protest movement, loosely referred to as wokeness, belongs to the second type. Last week, it had its first major encounter with electoral democracy, not only in the governor's race in Virginia, but also in referendum on replacing the police department in Minneapolis and on law and order issues in Seattle. Wokeness got clobbered, and not for the first time. What's wrong with a movement that, on its narrowest terms, aims to make Americans more aware of racial injustice, past and present? Nothing. In cases like those of Eric Garner, George Floyd, and Ahmaud Arbery, non-black America has had a long overdue education about the fact that black lives can still be subject to the same casual cruelties of a century ago. But like many movements that overspill their initial causes of action, wokeness now connotes much more than an effort to reform the police or denounce racial injustice when it occurs. It is an allegation that racism is a defining feature, not a flaw, of nearly every aspect of American life. That's profound, it's true, and it's alarming. I'll tell you what else is alarming. The amount of time and money put sometimes in movies that don't entirely live up to expectations. That's the case for a successful, economically, commercially, but I don't think artistically, film recently released. Listen.
Now it's time for MedVed's Entertainment Minute.
The Marvel Cinematic Universe has done very well with the Avengers movies, so now they're launching a new team of superheroes, immortal beings who are supposed to protect humanity through multiple millennia. That team is called the Eternals, now playing in theaters, eventually streaming on Disney+.
We're Eternals. We came here to protect humans from the Deviants.
We need to find the others.
When you love something, you protect it.
And the only way to protect yourself from the disappointments of this big splashy dud is to lower your expectations. Unlike other Marvel movies, none of the characters come across as compelling, and the dangers they confront going all the way back to Babylon seem to be a race of rabid monster dogs rendered in subpar special effects. Yes, these beings are supposed to be immortal, but you'll feel as if your time with the Eternals has lasted for an eternity. Rated PG-13 for the usual comic book violence, 1.5 stars for Eternals. And on the Michael Medved Show tomorrow, it's Veterans Day. And we are going to be speaking to Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, who was at one time Chief of Staff for Defense Issues for Vice President Mike Pence. He's now the co-chair of the Center for American Security. We'll also be speaking to another expert on American security, Arthur Herman, about what needs to be done to protect America and Americans, and Taiwan, by the way, from threats of a rising and remilitarizing China. And there's a report released by Pew Research Center that segments U.S. voters into 9 distinct political tribes. And guess what? They're all at war with one another. So which tribes are likely to survive and to continue to play a role? We will find out next time on the Michael Medved Show in This Greatest Nation on God's Green Earth.